Hey folks, it's your Monday Takeaway for February 5th, 2018. Remember, if you dig this podcast, go subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating or comment. Thanks.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us on this Monday, and congratulations to Eagles fans, especially our friends listening on WHYY in Philadelphia today. Super Bowl 52 went to those Philadelphia Eagles, a score of 41-33 over the New England Patriots. Philly quarterback Nick Foles led the Eagles offense to a huge night and a championship, and that trick play in the second quarter shocked everyone, gave Philly an early lead. Meanwhile, trick plays, they're not just for the Super Bowl, because over the weekend, President Trump peered into the FBI's playbook, as outlined in the infamous Nunes memo, and concluded that the Federal Bureau of Investigation used trick plays to try and hurt Trump. The tricksters? FBI leaders who used politically generated information to get surveillance warrants on Trump advisor Carter Page, the president says, despite the fact that Page had been under surveillance for years already. Another trick, former FBI Director James Comey announcing just days before the 2016 election that the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails was reopened. Comey didn't say anything about the investigation into contacts between the Trump campaign and Russians. Still, the president agrees with the Wall Street Journal that the FBI is a tool of anti-Trump political actors, and the president says the Mueller investigation, looking at obstruction of justice, is an American disgrace. It can be easy to lose sight of what a remarkable moment this is. The president of the United States training his political power publicly on the FBI, including appointees that he chose.
Well, this is unprecedented. We've never had a president so publicly attack the FBI.
Douglas Charles is associate professor of history at Penn State University at the Greater Allegheny campus.
Now, in the past, there have been times when there have been disagreements between presidents and the FBI. And even times, such as with President Nixon, that the president tried to stop an FBI investigation, for example, into Watergate. But all of that has always been done behind the scenes. So the fact that a president would publicly attack the FBI, and even beyond that, have allies in Congress joining him in doing that, this is completely unprecedented. We'd never seen this before.
And I want to talk about those allies in Congress in just one second, Douglas Charles. But talk about these conflicts. I mean, there have always been conflicts between the FBI and presidents. You mentioned that they tend to play out behind the scenes. What's changing? What's different? Is it just the personality of the current president, or is there something more?
Well, there's always been a component of personality in the relationship between FBI directors and the president. But in this case, it seems to be a partisan political attack in an effort to shut down the FBI's Russia probe. And from what I can tell, unlike, for example, Nixon, where he was doing it by trying to use the CIA to get the FBI to stop its investigation on national security grounds, and he also had his own man in there as FBI Director L. Patrick Gray trying to stop the Watergate investigation, in this case, Trump's strategy seems to be a public attack in discrediting the FBI. And if the FBI could lose stature, then this would perhaps, I mean, who knows, end the investigation or reduce it to something not believable.
Well, given what you know about the FBI's history and the way that it's structured, a lot of people suspected very strongly. In fact, there was some reporting that the president thought that if the Republican memo from the House Intelligence Committee impugned Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, that it could lay the pretext for the president to fire him. And by firing Rod Rosenstein, he might eventually be able to weaken or get rid of the special counsel. Bob Mueller, do you see that pattern?
That definitely is a pattern. That does seem to be the strategy of what's going on here. On the other hand, I don't think it's succeeding. There doesn't seem to be anything within this brief four-page memo that really indicts Rosenstein or really the FBI.
America has a history, though, if you look back a few decades, Douglas, of an extremely muscular, quite clandestine, and at certain points, very secretive FBI under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover. Talk a little bit about Hoover's tenure, his long tenure at the head of that organization, and then how Congress tried to change the FBI's relationship with the American people, essentially, after Hoover was gone.
Right. J. Edgar Hoover served as FBI director for almost 50 years. And the dynamic of when he was director was that, on the one hand, he had a very excellent public relations machinery in place. and purposely put forward this image of the FBI as moral, upstanding, professional investigators who always did everything properly. And then behind the scenes, of course, he was engaged in collecting non-criminal political intelligence, spying on civil rights activists, spying on minority groups and political opponents. And so that was the way things were handled in the Hoover era. And after Hoover's abuses became public following his death in the 1970s, Congress worked to try to enact an FBI charter, encoding into law what exactly the FBI could and could not do. Now, that never happened, and in place of that, we have a series of Justice Department guidelines defining the way the FBI carries out investigations, the way the FBI communicates with the White House. So ever since the 1970s, the FBI has been very professional, very upstanding in how it conducts its work. So the fact that in the course of its doing its job here, that it would be attacked as partisan just simply doesn't fit with the times, not at all.
Well, the CIA has a charter. They're not allowed to operate domestically. They're not supposed to participate in assassinations of world leaders they don't like. Why doesn't the FBI have one?
Right, exactly. The CIA does have a charter dating from 1947. Just the origins of the FBI are different. It was founded in 1908, and Congress never authorized the existence of the FBI. Instead, it was established through executive mandate by President Teddy Roosevelt. And afterwards, there was debate over whether this should happen, but the president convinced Congress that the FBI was needed, and it funded the FBI. But there is no charter defining precisely what the FBI can and cannot do. We simply have those guidelines, and those are Justice Department, Attorney General created guidelines that can be changed at any time.
Well, Douglas, I want to talk a little bit about House Republicans. You mentioned them. It's one thing to see a commander-in-chief with a certain personality or certain theories about his own government attacking the intelligence community or attacking the FBI. It's quite a different thing to see Republicans in Congress aid in this effort and really come to the president's side to try to make the case for him. Talk about Republicans in Congress and whether that situation is remarkable to you.
This is a very remarkable situation. Historically, there's always been one fan or supporter of the FBI in Congress, and that has been the Republican Party. And in fact, the FBI's relationship with congressional committees going back in history has always been one mostly of committees being deferential. During the Hoover years, congressional committees oftentimes received covert and secret help from J. Edgar Hoover. They received FBI information, all based on the understanding that this information would never be made public, this information would never be revealed as having come from the FBI, and if committees did that, Hoover would cut them off. Now that, of course, that sort of behavior ends after the 1970s, and so after the 70s, what the FBI then does is to provide oversight committees with information, but also on the understanding that this information would not be released. And that's exactly what happened here with the House Intelligence Committee. The FBI provided sensitive information about the Russia probe, and then the committee, in a partisan political manner, made it public for their own interests and the president's interests.
So what's going on now? I mean, why is the relationship between the FBI and House Republicans different now than it has been historically?
The only thing I can think to explain that is a partisan motive. The president wants to shut down the Russia investigation, and he has allies in Congress to help him do that. Now, we can compare this to Nixon. In the Nixon days with Watergate, he had no allies in Congress to help him try to stop the Watergate probe. And so on his own, Nixon did that behind the scenes. So this is a completely different dynamic. This is totally new and quite concerning.
Oversight is important, and I don't think most people who've watched the relationship between Congress and the FBI over the last couple of decades think that oversight has been everything that it could be. Republicans claim that this memo is just a form of oversight. Could it lead to the public knowing more about the FISA courts, the secret process, and whether anyone in law enforcement might have abused that process? That's important.
Well, this isn't oversight. The way oversight works is a committee forms. They invite the FBI director or anyone else to appear before the committee and answer questions. That has not happened here. They've simply taken information the FBI has provided and made it public. The FBI director even offered to appear before the committee and answer their questions about this, but they turned him down. So that indicates to us that this is a purely partisan effort and not really an effort at oversight. I mean, oversight doesn't work by leaking information. Oversight works by asking probing questions.
So, Douglas Charles, I guess we'll see whether the memo in the end is a dud or whether it provides the president a pretext to fire Rod Rosenstein and hobble the Russia investigation. We don't know that yet. But what are we looking at here if President Trump and his administration succeed in discrediting the FBI in the eyes of Congress and, more importantly, in the eyes of the American people?
Well, this is a very concerning thing. One reason the FBI succeeds so well is because it has a reputation. This is a long, long established reputation as professional investigators, and particularly so after the Hoover years, the FBI worked very hard to repair its image as an upstanding professional organization. And by discrediting it, by knocking it down a few pegs, that is an effort to make its work at least appear illegitimate. And that is clearly a strategy to reduce the effectiveness of its investigation into the Russia probe. So if this is successful, the fear would be that the FBI would stop being an independent agency and fall back into orbit around the president doing his bidding, like had been the case oftentimes under J. Edgar Hoover in the old days.
And I'll tell you, Douglas, I never thought I would see a day, even 5 or 6 years ago, that one of the preeminent anti-terrorism law enforcement organizations in the United States government, tasked with protecting Americans, would become the target of the commander-in-chief.
Absolutely. This is unexpected, and I think reflects the strange, very strange times we live in.
Douglas Charles, Associate Professor of History at Penn State University, the Greater Allegheny Campus. Doug, thanks.
Thank you.
The Federal Reserve has a new chair today. Jerome J. Powell takes over for Janet Yellen, the first woman ever to be appointed chair of the Federal Reserve. Yellen's presided over an economic rebound during her four-year term. She leaves office with unemployment at a 17-year low and low interest rates, too. Still, President Trump broke a 40-year tradition by not appointing Janet Yellen to his second term. She gave a rare interview to PBS's Judy Woodruff.
I would have liked to serve an additional term, and I did make that clear, so I will say that I was disappointed not to be reappointed. But I have had the privilege and the honor of serving in very high positions in the Federal Reserve System, and I'm very satisfied with the career that I've had.
A disappointed Janet Yellen there, but a Fed chair who left office using her power. On Friday, Janet Yellen imposed tough sanctions on banking giant Wells Fargo for consumer abuses in a final act as Fed chair. Diane Swonk is chief economist at Grant Thornton, and she joins me now. Diane, great to have you back.
It's good to be here.
Well, we're at near full employment, a key Fed goal. There are low interest rates, recovery from the 2008 crisis. By all measures, Janet Yellen appears to be a success. Why wasn't she rehired by President Trump?
Well, every president does get the opportunity to pick who they want to be Fed chair, and certainly this president has made it clear that he wants to pick his own people. That said, Chair Powell, who now takes over at the helm at the Fed, is someone who's been around the Fed since 2012. He was appointed by President Obama, and he is a Republican, but someone who's been very bipartisan in the past and also knows a lot about the plumbing of financial markets. So even though I am very, very saddened to see Chair Yellen go, I am somewhat hopeful that Chair Powell, at the very moment we may need him in terms of assessing asset price bubbles, that he will have some of the fortitude to understand what's going on in those markets.
And it sounded like in that interview with Judy Woodruff that Janet Yellen shares your sentiment, Diane, that she's sad to go too. What marks her key accomplishments during her 4 years as Fed chair?
Well, you know, her 4 years are only the end of what had been a very long career within the Fed. As she mentioned, that she's been at very high levels of the Fed. I think you already noted that, you know, when she took on the job as Fed chair, we were still in crisis era policies. We were still near zero on interest rates. The Fed balance sheet was still bloated and growing. And we saw the reversal of those policies. She gets to leave on a high note with the economy finally healing in a more fundamental way. One of the things that really made Chair Yellen stand out from other Federal Reserve chairs was how she not only looked at the economy in the aggregates on what was going on in unemployment, what's going on in inflation, but the components of those aggregates. She understood and made it her mission to explain that the overall unemployment rate itself was not a summary statistic before any politician did. She said it matters who's on the dance floor, who's participating in the labor market. The fact that a lot of prime age adults were not actually even looking for jobs really disturbed Chair Yellen. She knew that the only tool she had was a long expansion to lure people out of the sidelines and back onto the dance floor. That was something very important, and she really cared about individuals. And I think sometimes that got lost in translation, but it was clear in all of her speeches how much she spoke to the individual circumstances, not just the stock market, not just the aggregate numbers that we were reporting, but the unevenness that those averages actually portrayed.
Did Janet Yellen manage to get beyond her speeches? She might have expressed that to people when she gave speeches in that special Fed language that Fed chairs use. But did she translate it to policy in a meaningful way?
She did translate it to policy in that we have many fewer people accepting part-time jobs instead of full-time jobs when they were looking for that. We've seen the U6, which is a stress measure of unemployment, come down quite dramatically, but we're still not there yet. And I think she gets to leave on that high note of making progress, but the real challenge is the structural problems and erosion of skills of people who've been out for a very long time, the opioid crisis that makes it much harder to employ people than it did in the past. And what's most disturbing, and she's really shined a light on, is that women's participation in the labor force is now falling. It's now below that of other countries and below that of places like Japan. This is really important because women's participation in the labor market, their ability to provide for families, is one of the biggest indicators of the future of an economy going forward. They tend to get their children to college, higher educational attainment with working mothers. All of that is very important, and that's something we're still losing ground on.
And is there an indication that Jerome Powell, as he takes over the chair, picks up that mantle, not only on women in the workforce, but also on interest rates? Everybody's watching now to see when and how fast rates will rise. Do we have an indication of Jerome Powell's philosophy on those items and where things might go over the next year?
Well, Jay Powell also worked very closely with Chair Yellen, and I think what we have to keep into context is given that Jay Powell is not an economist, he will be relying more on the Fed staff for the economic analysis as he looks at financial markets and brings his strength there. That's very important because one of the legacies of Chair Yellen has been a major shift in the way all of the Federal Reserve System looks at the labor market. You've seen really the Fed board governors, the staff there that are going to be informing Chair Powell, and all the regional Feds think much more about inclusive growth, not just growth. Think about the details, digging deep into women's participation, digging deep into all these issues, rural versus urban divide, the opioid crisis. So her legacy is that she is the research she got started is going to continue to inform the board governors for years, if not decades, to come.
Diane, I want to ask you about Janet Yellen's last act as Fed chair. Sanctions on Wells Fargo for consumer abuses, an actual ban on Wells Fargo growing its business until they clean up consumer abuses and fraud. It was a rare and remarkable penalty. Was Janet Yellen using her power to send a message?
Well, I think the Fed was using its power to send a message. Remember, Jay Powell had to be in on this as well, the whole board of governors, including no appointees by the president. And in fact, the fact that the White House backed it up was also a fairly strong statement that this was not just a one-off and just a Janet Yellen show. This was something that was really in response to what was considered something very egregious, and we cannot tolerate it going forward. And I think that's an important message, that there's deregulation, but we still need to know the rules of the road to not crash into each other.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton. Diane, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
After 6 months of limbo, Kansas finally, officially has a new governor. Former Governor Sam Brownback is gone after being confirmed to be the Trump administration's ambassador at large for international religious freedom. Jeff Collier was waiting in the wings as a quasi governor in waiting when he was lieutenant governor, and now Jeff Collier has finally taken the oath. He is quasi no more. Governor Collier inherits a troubled state school system, however. We're going to talk about that next. And a Kansas government plagued by gridlock. For more, we turn to Stephen Caranda, State House reporter for Kansas Public Radio. Hi, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen, there was a lot of frustration in Kansas. Nomination moving slowly, Sam Brownback unwilling to give up that governor's office. Let me play this for you. This was Republican State Senator Bob Rebollier on our show last month.
We don't know how to move forward when we are not sure who we're going to be having as the possible big V veto ability.
Legislators in Kansas, Stephen, frustrated, not knowing how to move their state's policies forward. Some relief now?
Well, yes. So now the big question is, how is Collier going to handle things? On the campaign trail, he made a lot of hay saying, you know, he would change the tone. It would be a new day in Kansas. But he didn't give any specifics. We asked him many times about it. So now that he's actually governor, he still hasn't delivered a lot of policy specifics. But so far, he is kind of shaking things up in the governor's office. He's had a big replacement of some cabinet secretaries, shuffled around a lot of other staff, and is promising some further changes in state government. So now we're waiting to see how he plans on tackling these big issues like the school funding issue that you mentioned a moment ago.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that school funding issue in just a moment. Look, Kansas has faced major budget crises after Sam Brownback's tax cuts, his controversial state economic policies there. They've been trying to dig their way out. What's the size of Collier's challenge here?
Well, the budget is effectively pretty well balanced after last year they rolled back many of those tax cuts. But now the problem is that we have a state Supreme Court ruling that says school funding is inadequate. How much it will cost to comply with that kind of depends on who you talk to. But a lot of people float the idea of needing $600 million additional dollars, and we do not have that. So far, Governor Collier has said that we should not have another tax increase to tackle this. We're waiting for some information from a school funding study that's coming out next month. But right now, everyone's just kind of looking around, wondering how do we tackle this with the money we have, or if we need more, where do we get it?
Still, Stephen, Jeff Collier, as I said, sort of waited around for 6 months, waiting for Sam Brownback to get his new job or not, waiting for him to step aside or not. He has to run for re-election himself in a very short time. He doesn't have long to go to just do straight policy without a whole lot of politics here.
That's true, and he's been positioning himself to do as well as he can in the upcoming Republican primary. We have, I don't even remember the number, but a very crowded field of Republican candidates running for governor. So what he's been doing so far is positioning himself as kind of the conservative in the race, but who's maybe not as controversial as some of the other candidates, like our Secretary of State, Chris Kobach. So he's brought in experienced GOP staffers from the state party to work in his office. He is, as I mentioned, saying a new day in Kansas, a different tone compared to his predecessor Sam Brownback. While Brownback and Collier agree on many issues, Brownback was pretty unpopular based on survey results. So Collier so far is trying to kind of separate himself from Brownback without criticizing his former boss.
Former Governor Sam Brownback has left Kansas and joined the world stage as ambassador at large for religious freedom after a 6-month wait. And Jeff Collier, in waiting no more, governor of Kansas with a big fight on his hands. Stephen Caranda from Kansas Public Radio, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Budget fights in the Kansas school system go back more than a decade, but the controversy came to a head in the fall of last year when the Kansas Supreme Court unanimously ruled that the state is underfunding its public schools. The school district sued, arguing that the state cut school funding during the recession, that they never fixed it, and when the economy recovered, they just cut taxes instead. With a mess of this size, is the new governor, Jeff Collier, the man to fix it? Dana Miller is president of the Kansas Association of School Boards. She's also a board member at her local school district, Baser-Linwood, in Kansas. Dana, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Dana, there have been battles over public school funding in Kansas for a decade. From where you sit, what's the state of public schools in Kansas now?
You know, over the years, we have had fights, if you will, with the legislature over funding. We have had to reduce our cut positions and raise class sizes and eliminate programs to continue to fund our schools. I think that this is a new day in Kansas with our new governor, and we're very hopeful that our state legislature will come up with an appropriate and adequate funding plan.
Well, the money's been short. The courts got involved, of course. Yes. Talk a little bit about the effect in the classroom, on students, on teachers, and in the schools themselves.
As educators and board members, admin for our school districts in Kansas, I have to say we are very, very good at working to keep those cuts from affecting our kids for as long as we possibly could. But we have been dealing with this long enough that we're at a point where there's no way to keep it out of the classroom. So our kids lose their music program. It's on a cart. In our district specifically, in Basser-Linwood, when there was someone who quit or moved on, whether it was a janitor or a cook or a teacher, we didn't backfill those positions. And as you can imagine, that does affect our students when there's not a library aide to help in the library, or we're understaffed with support in the building. We have had to reduce the number of counselors and have taken our nurses out of the buildings. So we've not filled those positions. So it does affect our students. It does. We just are good at, you know, doing our very best with what we have, because that's what we do.
Well, now, Dana, there's an economic boom. There's more money coming in, $165 million available to state legislatures, it seems, that maybe they didn't expect to have. What's your hope now about how much of that money will go to schools?
You know, Governor Brownback, before he left, suggested that schools should receive over $600 million more dollars over 5 years. I think that obviously school districts are in a place where we need that funding. And while that is fabulous, we still have to go through the process and come up with a funding mechanism. And, you know, $165 million would be great, but we need more.
And Jeff Collier, the brand new governor, after all of this waiting in the wings for Sam Brownback to leave, what has he said about his strategy for your public schools?
You know, he just took office on Wednesday, and he has been working for months with our state commissioner and our Department of Education, our state board. He's been visiting schools. He called for an increase over the next 5 years. He said he wants to set a new tone for our state. So we have a good relationship with Governor Collier, and so we're hopeful that that means an increase and that means support throughout the legislature. He's a very conservative, has always historically been conservative. So we're hoping that he will be able to bridge the gap there for us.
Dana Miller, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Dana Miller is president of the Kansas Association of School Boards. It's one of the most lethal routes in the refugee crisis, Libya to Italy, across the Mediterranean. In 2016 alone, an estimated 4,500 migrants died making that trip. And last week, another migrant boat on that route capsized, killing all but just a few of the estimated 90 people aboard. What's unusual about this latest incident, though, is that the majority of victims were Pakistani. It turns out it's an indication of a broader trend. Last year, Pakistani migrants made up the 13th largest group trying to reach Europe across the Mediterranean, but this year, they're the third largest group. Here to explain the latest from this extremely dangerous migration route and a waning U.S. role on international migration issues is Kathleen Newland. She's senior fellow and co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute. Kathleen, thanks for being with us.
Hello, thanks.
Talk about this route between Libya and southern Europe. We've talked about it before on the program. What are conditions like now?
Well, January is always the most dangerous month for people trying to cross. The weather conditions are bad. There are storms. It's obviously colder than at other times of the year. So we tend to see fewer numbers trying to make the crossing in January. But the composition changes from year to year, depending on where the pressures are, depending on which routes are being favored by smugglers, and where people are coming from and under what conditions. So the rise in Pakistanis is unusual. We don't really know exactly what's behind it. there are at least three possibilities that I can think of. One is that smugglers are changing their routes as the Turkey to Greece route has been, if not shut down, at least constrained. Or these could be Pakistanis who'd been denied asylum in Greece and returned to Turkey under an agreement between the EU and Turkey and then tried to make their way from Turkey to Europe via Libya. Or they could be Pakistanis who'd been working in Libya under what used to be sort of normal circumstances and have decided that Libya is just getting too dangerous and uncertain for them to continue there and tried to get to Europe. We don't really know what their motivation was.
But do any of those factors give an indication of why Pakistanis are being driven from their own country in the first place?
Well, that's been true for quite some time. The violence and poverty in Pakistan is generic. The war in Afghanistan has ticked up. That may be placing new pressures on some people, but it seems that most of the Pakistani migrants are actually coming from the somewhat more prosperous parts of the country, from Punjab, from Sialkot, which has a lot of migrants already established. So these sort of network effects have an important impact, and also, you know, you see people coming from the slightly more prosperous parts of the country because they're the ones who can afford the journey.
What route are these Pakistani migrants taking from Pakistan that lands them in Libya? How do they get from Central Asia, South Asia, all the way to Africa?
Well, normally the most normal route would be to cross into Iran and then make their way from Iran across Turkey, perhaps, and North Africa into Libya. Some of the more prosperous ones may actually, you know, fly to a place like Egypt and then cross North Africa. But often people who are traveling this route don't even know what their route is going to be. If they place themselves in the hands of smugglers, the smugglers are going to find the path of least resistance. And at this point, the path of least resistance in terms of law enforcement seems to be the extremely dangerous route from Libya to Italy. Although that route, there's a crackdown on that route too since last August when the EU signed a deal with Libya, with one of the governments in Libya, in which they would train the Libyan Coast Guard to intercept boats and return migrants to Libya, where they face horrific conditions in government detention centers or in sort of holding centers that are run by the smugglers.
Meanwhile, there are changes at the United Nations. President Trump has appointed someone who's proven to be controversial to head up the UN International Organization for Migration, Ken Isaacs, has apparently made statements saying Islam is an inherently violent religion, that Christians should get preferential treatment as they resettle from violent places around the world. Who is Ken Isaacs, and is the world migration community as concerned about him as some of his critics seem to be?
I think there is a lot of concern about this nomination because the Director General of the IOM traditionally has been an American. That pattern may be broken this year with this nomination. Ken Isaacs is the vice president of a group called Samaritan's Purse, which is an evangelical humanitarian organization, does good work among refugees and other people in need, but it is an evangelical Christian organization, and Isaacs is on the record through his own Twitter account as being extremely critical of Islam and saying, as you mentioned, that Christians might need to get preference. Now, that's contrary to every principle of humanitarianism and international humanitarian law, which forbids discrimination on the basis of race or religion or ethnicity or nationality. Another point I would make about the nomination of Ken Isaacs to be head of the IOM, International Organization for Migration, is that IOM is much more than about humanitarian action. It's about helping countries develop and implement migration policies, which is in the interest of the receiving countries as well as is in the interest of countries of origin to get away from some of the chaos of the current practice and put a set of sort of rules around international migration, and particularly get some expectations working about how countries will interact around these issues in a way that encourages cooperation rather than confrontation.
Kathleen Newland is a senior fellow and co-founder at the Migration Policy Institute. Kathleen, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. We're starting a new book club here on The Takeaway today. It's called Reading the Reckoning. And this month, we've invited WNYC's producer for special projects, Rebecca Carroll, to host this book club for us. Over the next few weeks, Rebecca will introduce you to women authors expressing their strength, their conviction, their rage, and their joy through their writing. Today's book is So You Want to Talk About Race.
Our mom never thought that our blackness would hold us back in life. She thought we could rule the world. But that optimism and starry-eyed love was, in fact, born from her whiteness. It was almost impossible for her to see all of the everyday hurdles we had to jump, the tiny cuts of racism that we endured throughout our lives. For our mom, we were black and beautiful and smart and talented and kind, and that's all that mattered. And in the confines of our home, it was all that mattered.
An excerpt there read by Takeaway producer Dana Roberson. The book's author is Ijeoma Oluo. She's also editor at large for The Establishment and the first in our series of author interviews with Rebecca Carroll.
Hi, Ijeoma.
Hi.
Thanks for being here and talking about this new book. I have to say that given the sort of provocative, shall we say, tenor of some of your other work and writing, that I found this to be downright reader-friendly, generous, patient. Like, it was so patient. Where does all that patience come from?
I think part of the patience came from the fact that this is a book. And I was like, okay, you know what? Maybe if I lay it all out and very calmly get as much of it as I can out here, it will be something that will last with people. And maybe I don't have to keep writing the same essay over and over and over again, explaining things. I really wanted it to be something that people would have the energy to read multiple times if they needed to. And I think that does require a different tone.
The other thing that occurred to me, and I have written about this and had conversations about this, for those of us who are, for one way or another, raised by white parents, how that relates to our tolerance of white people. It feels to me like there's a lot of love that you feel for your mom. You also, your children, your sons have white fathers. How does that play into the way in which you address or approach conversations with white people about race?
Sometimes I can seem more patient, and sometimes I can seem far less patient. Having spent a lot of my life kind of surrounded by white people, I do sometimes think I have a greater understanding than a lot of people who don't have that regular access would have. But with that, that also means I fall for a lot less, and I have less patience for a lot of the things that I've heard maybe 100, 200 times. And so the conversation sometimes can be a lot more honest of, hey, you know what, I know what you're saying to me here, because right. I've heard it said, I speak white people too.
Right. And then there's that moment in the book where your mom is talking about how she said to this guy, or I have black children, so that counts for something. I know what you're going through. She said this to a black guy, right?
She was planning to. That was her big plan for the next day. And I had to stop her.
I've had the exact opposite response to being raised by white people. Like I feel like the older I get, the more I step into my life and myself as a mother, as a spouse, a partner, a writer, whatnot, the whiteness that I felt sort of inundated by just kind of falls away, which makes it difficult for me to talk with my son, who also has a white father, about whiteness and a tolerance for whiteness. Do you talk to your sons about their whiteness or the way in which their lives interact with whiteness?
Yes, I do. And I was very fortunate. I think a lot of black children and children of color raised by white parents kind of live in this space where parents don't talk to them about their racial identity. It's uncomfortable. And even though it was at times uncomfortable for my mom, she really was worried that we were going to grow up without black identity because our dad had moved back to Nigeria and then died. So she worked very hard to make sure that we knew that we were black and that we were beautiful. And granted, it wasn't the full experience because she had limitations as a white woman in what she perceived blackness to be. What I learned from my kids, especially my youngest and now my oldest as he's entering his teen years, is that, you know, they are fully aware but they have a racial identity. And if you're not talking about it with them, they feel gaslit. My youngest, especially, I noticed, he's almost as dark-skinned as I am. And so he was very aware that he was the only brown boy when he would go to his dad's house. And he started asking a lot of questions about the everyday choices that people around him were making that kind of erased his blackness. And so I learned that we do our children harm by not proactively talking about these things. They are seeing it and they're trying to make sense of it themselves. And it's our job to help guide them through it.
But so the disconnect of your mom really wanting to make sure that you all had very positive black identities, and then sort of saying to you as an adult, this is my plan as a way to talk to a black person, which completely is not the way to do it. So how did that happen? How could she be an advocate for you all and your racial identity and then not know how to talk about race?
It's very easy for a lot of people to think that proximity to black people is just as good as being black. And I think that my mom, someone who loved our blackness and tried best to make sure that we were surrounded by as many black people as she could find, as many Nigerians as she could find, she really thought that that meant she had transcended whiteness. And we hadn't had that conversation, that purposeful conversation around our roles in society and what our experience is, that she didn't quite get that she still had never lived a single day as a black person. And she thought she kind of had a pass. And she had no ill intention whatsoever. It's an easy trap that a lot of people fall into, to think that just having a friend is empathy enough. And we hear that all the time, right? I have a black friend. I have a black wife. And we think that, you know, people think that that means that they know what it's like. My mom knows what it's like to raise black children. That's a very specific experience. But she doesn't know what it's like to be a black person.
How much do you think living in Seattle, Washington, which is not exactly a bastion of diversity, affects the way in which you talk about and understand race and racial identity?
I think it had a huge impact on my life in understanding race and racial identity. Seattle is a weird place. There's hardly any black people there, and especially when I was growing up, there were hardly any at all. My brother and I were the only black kids that we could see until probably about seventh grade. And it creates this weird world because in Seattle, it's rude to talk about race. So there was something very visibly different about us. We were definitely treated differently. And when you're the only black kids, you're very black all of a sudden.
Is it more rude to talk about race in Seattle than it is in Arkansas or San Francisco?
Yes. Yes. There's a hostility to bringing up race. In fact, in many ways, it's far more rude to address issues of race than to be racist. And there have been plenty of times where I'll say, hey, can we look at the racial aspect of this, whether it's in the arts or in literature? And someone will say, well, that's rude. I mean, it's literally the response that you will get. People really value calm politeness, and they want to paper over any idea of racial animosity or racial issues in society. And so we were very visible. Different and treated very different, but no one would give words to it. My brother and I were always very hyper aware of our race. We didn't have a space, a social space, where we felt comfortable and we could let that go. We didn't have a friend group of black people. It was literally just my brother and I for most of our formative years. And so it kind of made me into an observer, and my brother as well. You know, you can't quite fit in. So you're watching and trying to figure out what's the key to this.
And so what keeps you there? Well, how do you choose to raise your children there? You know, I mean, I'll tell you a story. You know, I was adopted into a white family and raised in an all-white town. And when my son was maybe 5 or 6 years old, I brought him up to New Hampshire to visit with my parents, and we were at a restaurant. And he looked around the restaurant and he leaned into me and said, Mom, why is everybody white here? And that he had that awareness, that consciousness, that cognizance, that racial cognizance, to me, is why I don't live in New Hampshire. So I'm curious, as a mother of mixed and black children, having had the experience that you had growing up, what goes into your choice to stay?
I think a lot of it is, A, I've been very intentional in where I live. So I tried to live in one of the more diverse neighborhoods. My brother does as well. My brother lives in probably the most diverse neighborhood in the city. There is a population of people of color in Seattle, a long history of arts and artists of color in Seattle who have been kind of forced to become incredibly creative. And I think that's, you know, black ingenuity is not new. And I've been lucky to find that community, and I'm invested in that community. And so the network I've built there of not only my brothers and my sister, but the greater arts community itself, it's something I want to fight for. I don't want to be one of the countless Black people who have been pushed out of their homes. And we're losing people every month. And so I'm here like saying, you know what, this is my home too. And I want to fight for every person of color here and help keep them here. So I'm trying to find ways where, you know, people can afford to stay in a rapidly gentrifying and increasingly expensive area so we don't lose the culture that we've fought so hard to build.
What did you learn about yourself when you were writing this book?
You know, one thing about doing this work, I think, is we are constantly kind of drinking from a fire hose. There's so much happening. There's so much that you have to do. Every day there's a new think piece that you need to write because you want someone to understand something about an issue. And I realized how little time is dedicated to actually looking at how these things are impacting us individually on a personal level. How little time I've been able to dedicate to broader scholarship because I'm so busy having to deal with these urgent current issues. And I realized how much more of my career I would love to be able to dedicate to that, but also how much of my self-care and community care I would love to look at, the toll this is taking on people of color. The lack of scholarship given by major universities toward the efforts that we've put forward, what's working, what isn't, and what we need to do to make sure that not only are we lifting this oppression, but we're doing so in a way that heals and helps those who've been impacted by it.
Ijeoma Oluwo, thank you. The book is called So You Want to Talk About Race. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
WNYC's Rebecca Carroll and Ijeoma Oluwo in conversation there as part of our book club series, Reading the Reckoning. If you want to read along with us or sign up to participate, you can find a list of books at thetakeaway.org, and we might pick you to join us for an on-air discussion later this month. That does it for us today. In the meantime, thanks as always for joining us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.